You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 3rd of April, 2024. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Coming up on today's programme, rescuers search for survivors after Taiwan is struck by its most powerful earthquake in 25 years. NATO leaders meet in Brussels to celebrate the alliance's 75th anniversary. But is it fit for the future?
He invaded Ukraine and sent a clear message that he doesn't want more NATO on his borders. He's getting the exact opposite. He's getting more NATO presence in the eastern part of the alliance. And then he's getting two new members, Finland and Sweden. And with Finland, NATO's border with Russia more than doubles.
Why Greenlanders are demanding answers and compensation from the Danish government for a mass forced sterilisation programme in the 1960s and 70s. Plus the latest business and fashion news too. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Vincent McAvinney. Taiwan's government says at least 9 people have died and over 800 have been injured after a 7.4 magnitude offshore earthquake struck the eastern coast of the island. Buildings in the capital, Taipei, and surrounding areas shook violently, and it is feared dozens of people are trapped under rubble near the epicentre. William Yang is a freelance journalist based in Taipei. He joins me now. William, firstly, can you tell us a bit about your own experience of the quake today?
So I essentially started the day by being shaken up by the earthquake. Originally, I thought it was just another typical smaller scale earthquake that Taiwanese people have been very used to. So I thought I could sleep through it. But in fact, it started getting bigger and bigger and shakier and shakier. And so I immediately realized that I needed maybe hit under the table and try to get through the first earthquake. And in between the first and the second earthquake, I immediately went over to open the door of my flat and just started looking online to see the magnitude and the epicenter of the earthquake and if any major casualties and damages have already been reported.
And President Tsai Ing-wen says Taiwan's military will be deployed in the rescue operations. How widespread is the damage?
So, in fact, the damage, most of the very serious ones are concentrated in the eastern part of Taiwan. That's also very close to the epic center. That part of Taiwan is always vulnerable to large and major earthquakes like this. There have been major earthquakes like this in the past that caused buildings to collapse. And today, no surprise that several buildings unfortunately collapsed and several people were trapped in there. One of them eventually, unfortunately, lost their lives. But I think another thing to note is that because most of the major roads, including railways into this part of Taiwan has been cut off or suffer serious damages. And so the government is trying hard to use other ways like airways or like the sea transport to evacuate people that need to leave that part of Taiwan.
And there's been some criticism already that Taiwan's emergency alert system failed to warn people. I mean, how good is this system normally?
So the system normally would send out text messages to people around Taiwan seconds before the actual earthquake would happen to warn them to take shelter and stay at a certain place. But today, including myself, millions of people unfortunately didn't get the text message. And the authorities later admitted that because of the underestimation of the initial earthquake. And so they omitted and left out certain parts of Taiwan for the text message. And that's why some people like myself didn't receive it. Mm.
Offers of assistance have come in from several countries, of course, but one notable one was China. Was that a surprise given the nature of relations at the moment? And will that be taken up at all?
So the initial willingness expressed by China's Taiwan Affairs Office has kind of been kindly turned down by the Taiwanese authorities because they simply said that at this point the damages and the casualties, the scale of it is within Taiwan's own capacity to handle. I think this reflects a little bit of a different case compared to in the past when both sides of the Taiwan Strait will be definitely offering a lot of the support like this. But unfortunately for this one, they just cannot really, I think they have to take the political sensitivity into calculation.
And there's going to be disruption, of course, to Taiwan's high-tech manufacturing industry, crucial for manufacturers around the world, of course, with those semiconductors. What's the situation at companies like TSMC?
So actually, TSMC immediately came out hours after the initial earthquakes and said that they are still operating. They have evacuated a very small number of their staff, but their plants are operating at the, close to normal level. And I think because Taiwan is so prone and vulnerable to earthquakes already, most of these manufacturers are very skilled and experienced to deal with this kind of natural disaster.
William, thank you. That was journalist William Yang speaking to us from Taipei. Now, 75 years ago tomorrow, the North Atlantic Treaty was signed by 12 nations in Washington, D.C., founding NATO. The short treaty, consisting of a mere 14 articles, most famously enshrines the collective defense of members under Article 5. Over the decades, the alliance has grown to 32 members, with Sweden joining just last month, meaning it now protects some estimated 950 million people. Joining us from Washington, D.C. to discuss the health of the alliance is Robin Quinville, director of the Wilson Center's Global Europe Program and a former U.S. diplomat. Robin, thank you for being on the program. Firstly, how is NATO marking this anniversary?
Well, they will have a foreign ministers meeting in Brussels on the 4th. But more importantly, they will have the summit in Washington, D.C. in July, from July 9th to 11th. And that is marking the 75th anniversary.
And what's expected at that summit?
Well, I bet you could even identify some of those issues that are going to be on the table. First, they need to have a new Secretary General. Hopefully, they will get there before the summit. But it will be a look at forward leaning, the NATO of now and the NATO of the future. And the big question that will be on the agenda is, of course, Ukraine. You remember there was a summit in Vilnius last year, and the question of NATO membership, would NATO issue an invitation to Ukraine to join, was the big question hanging over that. And I think that question hangs over the Washington summit as well. We see that it is two years into the fight. It'll be 2.5 years by the time of the summit. And the question still remains, what will the alliance do? It's enlarged. It's added Finland and Sweden to it. What will it do for Ukraine? And I think they'll grapple with that at the NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels, and they will grapple with that right up to the summit. Mm.
The alliance has seen huge changes, including the rise and fall of the Soviet Union. But is it under a particular moment of pressure right now with a resurgent Russia?
Yes, it is. And this is how NATO has really changed over time. There is nothing like a present threat to change your threat perception. And that is what has happened within the alliance. You know, in 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine, the alliance still had a strategic concept that did not see Russia as a threat. It does now because it has revised that strategic concept. And it only does that every few years. So this is something where we now see the alliance looking at where does it have its forces, what does it need to build for deterrence, how will it do that? And individual countries are, of course, also making that assessment.
And Russia seems to have made accidentally NATO stronger in the past 2 years. You've got many members now stepping up to the 2% funding commitment and potentially going beyond it. Is that going to be enough?
It is certainly necessary because for many, what the fight in Ukraine showed was when they wanted to transfer items to Ukraine to support Ukraine in its fight, they were discovering their own level of readiness and their own level of investment had made them vulnerable. And so they know that they need to resupply and relook at their militaries, including their personnel policies. And not just because of Ukraine, but because they see that there is now a threat for which they must be strong for deterrence. And that is something that they are now working on. We see it in countries across the board. Hopefully, by the time of the summit, the Secretary General will be able to say that maybe even up to 20 of the 32 alliance members are meeting their 2% of GDP defense investment that they had pledged in Wales in 2014.
Well, on that point, there's been a frenzy of NATO activity in the past 18 months, and they've been much more sort of public about getting, you know, film crews and TV crews in to see their exercises, the recent ones in the Nordics and the Balkans. How future-proofed is the alliance?
You know, the alliance has always exercised, right? And it does this intense coordination with military planners and so forth. And this often happens, and I think has in the past often happened, kind of out of sight of everyone, off the books a little bit, not as publicly. And I think it's wise of the alliance to now say, right, let's show what we are doing. Again, this is a part and parcel of how you do deterrence. You show your strength and you show that you are preparing and exercising. And I think that they will do more of that, because what they are really showing is we are every day at the alliance assessing, planning, assessing the totality of the alliance's strengths.
And one person who is particularly concerned with that 2% target is, of course, the former president, Donald Trump. Is there, you know, he's threatened already if he gets into power that he might take the US out of NATO. Is there a way to sort of preempt things, to get things in order, to try and keep him, to keep America in place if he does succeed?
I think what we need to focus on is the fact of burden sharing, right? And as a former diplomat, I will say that my talking points on burden sharing were not substantially different between one administration and another, starting in 2014, as we were pushing for the Wales Pledge for 2% of GDP. And so I think that when you see something that has been an issue across administrations, right, then the idea that is, okay, let us address that. And the alliance, to be fair, and partly because of this changed threat perception, is actually addressing that, the member countries of the alliance. But there's also more that I think they and we need to do. We are all looking at the defense investment and the defense industry and how capable is that of resupply and so forth. So that's going to be also an issue for the future.
And just turning once again to Ukraine, I mean, you know, it's been offered EU membership. It's in the process now to join that union. In terms of joining NATO, do you think we'll see any kind of movement at that Washington summit in the summer? Because there are criticisms that NATO perhaps has been a bit too timid, that it should be a bit more robust in its dealings with Russia. Do you think we might see a kind of, you know, hint that that is on the cards?
Well, while I'm an advocate of issuing an invitation because it would put Ukraine in the process, I think that's not where the summit is going to come out, because, you know, the summit works by consensus and you have to have consensus by all 32. I think that what they will do, though, and what they know, is that there must be a package that they are able to bring together that helps Ukraine to meet its needs and that is a meaningful answer to those needs. So if it's short of membership, it must be robust. And I heard the secretary was in Paris yesterday, Secretary Blinken, and he referred to this as a bridge. And frankly, it's if they are crafting Ukraine's bridge to NATO, which is short of an actual invitation, as one of my friends said, that bridge better be short, well-lit, and obstacle-free. So, and it must be something that both the alliance and Ukraine can celebrate.
A good way to describe it. Robin, thank you. That was Robin Quinville, director of the Wilson Centre's Global Europe Programme. Now here's Tom Webb with today's other news headlines.
Thanks, Vincent. US President Joe Biden said he was outraged and heartbroken about the Israeli strike that killed 7 aid workers in Gaza. The American leader criticized Israel for not doing enough to protect aid workers and civilians, but didn't signal any shift in US military support for the country. Thailand's Constitutional Court has accepted a petition filed by election authorities seeking to dissolve the Move Forward Party, dealing another blow for the popular opposition movement. The president of Botswana has threatened to send 20,000 elephants to Germany amid a diplomatic row over trophy hunting. President Masisi suggested in an interview that Berlin should try living with elephants to experience the challenges the endangered species bring to the community. The Botswana leader was responding to Germany's environment ministry, suggesting that there should be tougher rules on importing hunting trophies. And the White House has instructed NASA to develop a standardized time system for the moon and other celestial bodies. The space agency has been tasked with devising a plan to set a coordinated lunar time by the end of 2026. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Vincent.
Thanks, Tom. To Greenland now, where a group of 143 Inuit women are suing Denmark for just over $6 million after having been forcibly fitted with IUDs in the 1960s and 70s. Denmark has launched an investigation into the insertion of an estimated 4,500 coils into women and girls as young as 13 without their knowledge. The campaign was aimed at limiting population growth in Greenland. The population was booming at the time thanks to high standards of living and healthcare. Well, joining me now from Newark is Sarah Olsvig, a Greenlandic politician, former MP and international chair of the Inuit Circumpolar Council. Sarah, thank you very much for joining us. Firstly, can I ask, what was the impact on the community? Because this is the equivalent of half the women and girls of fertile age at the time in Greenland effectively being sterilized.
Well, first of all, of course, it had a massive impact on the decline in population growth. We see on the numbers that there was a very, very clear and massive decline in the number of children that were born since the so-called IUD campaign was initiated by the Danish state. And what we are learning in these latest years, since women started to stand up and speak about what they had been through, is the massive influence on the mental health of the women that have been fitted with our IUDs. And I want to make clear that some women did consent, but there is a large number of women and girls who did not consent, or where the parents did not consent, and some where they didn't even know that they were fitted with an IUD. So this situation is actually developing as we speak. It's only a few years, 2 years back, that the first woman stood out and spoke about this in public. We have all been very shocked to learn of the high numbers, and also to learn from reporting by media what the whole reason for the massive number of fitting women and girls with IUDs were. So this was an actual campaign led by the Danish health authorities in the 60s and 70s. So the investigation that's going on, that is initiated by the government of Greenland and Denmark, will be very important. But we from the human rights organizations, including from the Inuit Circumpolar Council, have been criticizing that the investigation will not include a human rights perspective. And now we have learned that the government of Greenland will do their own investigation, laying out and uncovering what human rights are affected here, both individually and collectively.
Why did this only come to light in the last few years? Because, as you say, there would have been a dramatic fall in the birth rate. Why wasn't this sort of cottoned on to earlier?
In the 70s, abortion was also free. Abortion was also introduced in Greenland, and there were several different kinds of initiatives that were aimed at, of course, providing women with the choice of family planning, but apparently also campaigns that were designed to be implemented without the free and prior consent of the women in question. So it was not as such a surprise that the 60s and 70s, and especially the 70s, that there was a decline in the number of population. But the surprise is that so many women and girls actually had contraceptive devices or medicine given to them without their knowledge. Mm. I think that this has been a major taboo among many women. And we are in complete awe of the courage that women who have stood up and spoken and told their story in the latest years, they have truly been the ones who are the reason that this has come out in the light, the way that things were done. And this is, of course, also immediately calls for action by the governments and everyone else to make sure that we learn exactly what has been going on and what are the reasons for such inhumane policy, as I would call it.
Well, on that point, there are now sort of two routes forward to try and get some resolution on this. There is an investigation by the government. There's gathering of testimony going on. Do you have faith in that? And what are you attempting to achieve as well with the lawsuit, aside from obviously compensation for the victims?
Well, I hope that the victims will have a positive process through the court system. And I think it's also a good thing that individual women are taking up their cases in the court system towards the Danish state. But I think it's going to be very important that these investigations are going to be thorough. And I see the Greenlandic Danish investigation that has already been launched as more of a facts-finding investigation. What I think is lacking, and which I hope the government of Greenland with their own investigation on the human rights aspects, is the more human side of it. What were the consequences for the women, for their families, their parents, their husbands, for the collective society as a whole? Because I think that these experiences, of course, have manifested both with the individual women. There's a lot of scars that are still open. This, of course, affects the collective society. This is something that we will overcome, but it needs to be fully investigated. And we need also to focus on the human side of things and also work with the international society in learning why these things happen so we can ensure it doesn't happen again. We do see still today that there are cases of forced sterilization among Inuit, for example, in Canada. So we have a lot of work to do to ensure that this systemic discrimination that has happened, that we end it. And for doing that, we need to know the facts, but also the human consequences and the human rights aspects of it.
Sarah, thank you. That was Sarah Olsvig. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Time now to get the latest business headlines with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Ewan, an update from Tesla, which turned out to be even worse than analysts were forecasting. What's gone wrong?
Yeah, we recently talked about how analysts have been downgrading their forecasts for electric car maker Tesla. Well, in the end, it was worse than anybody was expecting. They reported their worst ever sales miss. Over the quarter, they produced 45,000 more cars than they sold. That's by far the biggest gap that's ever been reported from Tesla. Now, the company's already warned that its rate of growth will be notably lower this year, blaming interest rates hikes and their effect on the consumer. And they have to deal with multiple disruptions at its plants outside Berlin as well. But perhaps the most serious thing facing China is Tesla's increasingly cutthroat EV market in China. Now, of course, it is the world's biggest car market, but the company is confronted with unprecedented local competition and weakening consumer sentiment. The market share in China is now less than 7%. That's down from 10.5% at the start of last year. Now, Tesla's long prided itself on cutting-edge technology, but at the moment, it's competing with just two vehicles in China, the Model 3 sedan and the Model Y SUV. And both models date back from pre-pandemic times, launched before 2020, and they've had relatively minor updates since their introductions. And the competition is really hotting up in China. There is a list of EV makers in the country as long as your arm. And just to give you an example of what the company is up against, BYD, the biggest EV maker in China, has a hatchback with a 10-inch rotating touchscreen, which retails for under $10,000.
Wow. You've done an entire Tesla story there without mentioning one man, Elon Musk. How much is he at fault for, you know, a dramatic collapse in the share price when many stocks in the sort of tech sector have, you know, rocketed this year? Is there calls perhaps for someone else to take over this company yet, or does he have a plan to get things back on track?
Well, as you say, the tech rally has been quite something. It's continued into the course of 2024, but Tesla has not participated in this. Their shares are down considerably over the last few months. I think it is very tough for Tesla to compete in China. Its models are particularly old. There's been a lot of pressure on the company to come up with new designs. It does have some in the works, but they're not due out anytime soon. They're competing relatively well in the rest of the world, but there is a global slowdown in the take-up of EVs. The take-up has just not been as fast as many people expected. Of course, this is a company really driven from the center, so you can lay the blame for a lot of this at Elon Musk's feet. But of course, shareholders in Tesla have had a great run. Those who have held shares in the company for a number of years have seen their investments really rocket. So there's quite a lot of loyalty towards Elon Musk. And we all know he has certain pronouncements which get investors looking a little bit puzzled. But on the whole, he's done really well by them. So there's no moves at the moment for investors to want to get him out of the door just yet.
And elsewhere, disagreement over how far central banks should have to take into account climate risks in their policies.
Yeah, these are closed-door discussions at the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. Now, this brings together representatives from regulators and central banks around the world to coordinate rules and oversight of the banking system. It sounds pretty dry, but it is very important. And according to sources we've spoken to, European central bankers have been advocating for the committee to require lenders to disclose their strategies for meeting green commitments for tackling climate change. But US officials have cited the Basel Committee's narrow mandate and concerns that it's overstepping its purpose. So there's really quite a transatlantic rift on this one. The Fed, the Basel Committee itself, and the ECB have all declined to comment on the discussions which we've been made party to. Fed Chairman Jay Powell, though, in the past has made clear that the Fed shouldn't be mistaken for what he calls a climate policymaker. So the Federal Reserve has been pretty clear it doesn't want to get involved too closely in the fight against climate change. All of this coincides with a wider pushback in the US that's included Republican-led legal attacks against financial firms that factor ESG, environmental, social and governance issues, into their investing decisions. So like so much else in the US, the issue of companies and their environmental policies has become highly politically charged. And now that's now being played out on a global scale as well.
Ewan Potts, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And finally on today's show, it's time for a roundup of fashion news with Monocle's fashion director, Natalie Theodosi, who joins me in the studio. But first, let's begin with news that Zara and other fashion brands are reopening their stores in Ukraine. Monocle researcher Julia Lasica, a Ukrainian national, is also here with us in the studio. Julia, you've been covering this story. How big a deal is it?
Thanks for having me on. It's a really big deal because back in the end of 2023, when we were first talking about other fashion brands opening in Ukraine, like Pandora, and of course the first ones to open when the full-scale invasion started, but Inditex, the return of Inditex, and that includes Zara, Oysho, Pull&Bear. This is a huge deal for Ukrainian customers and Ukrainian clients going to those stores because there's just a lot more choice now on the high street.
And what's the reaction been like in Ukraine? Are people wanting to, you know, are they going out? Are they wanting to dress up in new things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are queues today in the major malls where they've opened up. So I think there's just excitement. I think there's a, you know, you want to feel like there's something special in your life. I think for our listeners, it might be relatable. During the COVID lockdown, you wanted to dress up a little bit more. You wanted to feel good about yourself. Control the little things that you can when there's something like this going on. And I think also it's just the kind of the choice. The choice is now greater because lots of things went off the market. I mean, at one point it was even hard to find, for example, pants to buy or socks. So necessities. So it's good to have these things back in the country.
Good. Well, we're going to turn now to the other fashion news. Natalie, some news out of PR. PVH, the owner of the likes of Calvin Klein and Tommy Hilfiger, and they haven't been having a good time.
That's true. I think it was announced that PVH expects sales to fall by 6 to 7% throughout the year. Given microeconomic factors, there's been a slowdown in Europe in particular. And as a result, overnight after they made that announcement, their shares tumbled by 20%, which is quite a dramatic drop. Mm. And I think it just shows that these are issues and challenges that the whole industry is facing, given supply chain issues, the broader macroeconomic factors. But it's also a testament to how difficult it is to revive heritage labels like Tommy Hilfiger, like Calvin Klein. I think they haven't had a lead creative director to bring them to write a new chapter for a while. And there's been a lot of really successful celebrity campaigns, but it's clear that I think that power of celebrity cannot do everything.
Is there also, for sort of the people that they normally target, so say sort of 35 under, the sort of recent trend of the last 18 months has been a lot of very vintage wear, a lot of 90s stuff, there's been huge vintage sales, and people are wanting to kind of not get new for sort of environmental reasons and go and get older items, but also that style, that sort of big baggy style has come quite back in.
Absolutely. I think consumption trends are changing vastly across all generations, but especially the younger generation, which you're right, they might be more likely to shop for vintage Tommy Hilfiger jeans on an app like Vinted or Depop rather than go and buy something new in the store where the price is higher, the style might not be as interesting, and it's also not sustainable.
And there's news about Paul Smith.
Yeah, slightly happier news on this one. Paul Smith is going, has been announced as the guest designer of PT Uomo, the menswear fair in Florence, happening this June. And it's quite exciting because he's returning after 31 years. He showed there as kind of a young up-and-coming designer at the time, and he's now coming back and opening the fair. And what was quite interesting was that he said he remembers showing back then at a time when fashion shows were intimate. It wasn't kind of that big global affair, and he wants to offer something like that, something that's going to be intimate. It's about clothes, about tailoring traditions. So I think it will be a really nice event to watch.
And finally, Volgari has a new creative director.
It does, and it's the first time that a jewellery house like Bulgari has announced a creative director. It's the Greek designer Mary Katranzou, who used to run a business out of London, but during the pandemic, she had to wind down operations and scale the business down. So it's exciting to see her back in action, and it will be interesting. I think she will be designing across jewellery, but also leather goods. And it will be interesting to see what a creative director can do in a jewellery house and how that can change their trajectory.
Natalie, thank you. That was Monocle's fashion director, Natalie Theodosi, and our researcher, Julia Lassica. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Emma Searle. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Tamsin Howard. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.